Welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Killa. Rav Aviva Richman and Rav Ethan Tucker spend a lot of time thinking about halacha and Jewish values. In this panel discussion given at Hadar's February Learning Seminar, Hadar's Rashei Yeshiva reflect on their approach to Jewish law and how our quest for God can be lived through the details of our halachic lives. Let's listen.
I just want to start by saying, when I think about halacha and what that is exactly, I have to say for me, the word law and the word value or values aren't sort of the immediate things that come to mind. But I'm very happy we'll be engaging with those topics. For me, when I think of what is halacha and what has it meant in my life, it's essentially the desire and practice to instantiate being in relationship with God and Torah in the very details of our lived lives. So not just in our ideas, and not just in our learning, not just in our heads, not even just in our hearts, but in the actual practical details of our lives as we live them, day in, day out, and sort of all realms of our life, daily personal life, interpersonal life, between us and sort of our prayer life, and all sorts of aspects of communal life. And I'll just reflect a little bit also to share a bit biographically of where I'm coming from, but where I'm coming from I think also touches on different understandings of what halacha is across different communities. I sort of growing up encountered two very different approaches to halacha, would be kind of a generous term to use. I felt in one community that I lived in and was exposed to, which was a sort of very beautiful progressive chavura that I was a part of with my dad and his community, I would say halacha was like not a word on the table at all. There was a lot of striving for meaning making in how people approach their Jewish lives. This may be one example. I had very, very close friends for their bat mitzvah. They made a talit and sort of designed it themselves and put a lot of thought into what design they wanted to put on it. And then maybe like didn't wear it all that often, like didn't use it all that often. So it was like extremely meaningful, but also like not such a part of their day-to-day life. And on the other hand, I was in a world with my mom and sort of the more Orthodox community in Baltimore where halacha was like very much a word, but felt a little bit more rote and not so tied to meaning making. So they are right with, and certainly had very clear gender boundaries. So there was sort of like my friends who were young women at the time, like we're not making a talit, we're certainly not wearing a talit, but also like weren't kind of thinking that much about meaning making in their religious lives. So I feel like for me and what it means to me to be part of the world of Hadar and Hadar's Torah and how we approach halacha, like one thing that is so much on my mind is what does it look like to kind of expect halacha to be able to contain our quests for religious meaning making, to expect that the details of what halacha has to say about things like our obligations in prayer are not just kind of rote checkboxes that you may be interfaced with daily but don't mean that much, right? To sort of expect that our very human yearnings and very human sort of emotional turmoil of our life where like we might want prayer as an outlet, that like that actually should somehow intersect with halacha as a container for some of the concrete ways in which we are living out our religious lives. So that's sort of one example through prayer. But I would say I'm sort of feel like I'm on this ongoing quest to do two things at once, interfacing with many different people across the Jewish world. Right? One is to kind of share with people who are kind of striving to want more connection with God in sort of concrete ways throughout their lives, to like know about halacha and the details of halacha as a practice that is there that you could have more in your life and that can really interact with your experience. And on the other hand, people who maybe are sort of familiar with halacha as mostly a set of rules, to kind of push on that and really like allow people to dream and imagine that halakha could actually intersect in a much more dynamic way with your experience and kind of what you care about and are passionate about. That's my kind of opening remark, you know, a little bit about where I'm coming from and what I'm longing for when it comes to what halakha could be. And I think the last piece that I'll maybe share on this is when we get stuck, and people can get stuck kind of from multiple directions, I think part of what our Beit Midrash is here for is to say that like a pathway forward for halakha to become a more kind of meaningful container for our religious experience, when we get stuck on that, because it seems like, you know, halakha is like too rigid, you know? When I see people who say they're halakhically observant, actually, like, that does not seem like it interfaces with a lot of my concerns and what I need in my life. But when we get stuck, and the answer is to lean in more deeply. And I think for me personally, that's what a lot of my life has been about. When I graduated college, I took a number of women's studies classes in college and then spent a year after college going to study in Pardes and to study halakha kind of seriously. And I felt like part of that was, instead of assuming that halakha is actually like more alienating because of all this work that I've done on gender studies, I actually think if I spend more time getting into the complexity of halakha and studying the kind of dynamic nature of the development of halakha, I will be able to find more and see more and be inside this world, and that will lend itself to more meaning making. So I would say those are the two things I want to lead with: the possibility that halakha and our quest for meaning making could really be paired, and that to make that work, we can lean in more to uncover the dynamic development of halakha throughout the ages.
Yeah, so I'll jump in with some maybe complementary thoughts and language to what Rabbi Aviva just shared. Go with me for a minute back to the early chapters of Bereshit. The first chapters of Genesis tell you famously kind of two very different stories about the origin of humanity and what's the interaction with God. Structured in very different ways, the human being the culmination at the end of chapter 1 and chapters 2 and 3 being the beginning of it all, and other creatures being pulled in. Strikingly, they both feature the core opening interaction between God and the human being around a demand or an expectation, or what we would call more broadly a mitzvah, right? A commandment. The stuff that makes up halakha, as it were. In the first chapter, it's Pru urvu milu et haaretz, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. There's a charge, an expectation. Okay, I've created you, now I need you to do this. And in the second story, it's Umipri eitz hagan, Umipri eitz asher betoch hagan lo tochlu mimenu. Don't eat from the tree that's in the middle of the garden. It is, I think, actually quite striking how those two stories frame those two different commands. The first story actually frames what is understood, certainly in later rabbinic tradition, to be a command, actually as a blessing. Vayivarech otam Elohim lemor. God blessed them by saying, Pru urvu. It's still in a command form, right? It's not, I hope you will be fruitful and multiply. It's, I need you to go do this. But there's actually a sense conveyed by the language and by the reader. This is good for you. This is something you would want to do. I'm actually giving you this expectation as a kind of fulfillment of your intended purpose. The second story uses a very different verb, Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al Adam. The Lord God commanded the human being. No sense of it necessarily being a blessing, no sense of whether the human being is in any way bought into the command. And we all know where that goes, which is to a failure to keep it. But I call attention to another piece in that story, which perhaps gets at the heart of what went wrong there, and I think so much of what we try to undo, as it were, in this space, God's question to the human being after that first sin is not, how dare you violate my command? It is, Ayeka. It is, where are you? And that question, I think, in some basic sense, is actually God asking the genuine question, are you in this with me, or are you outside? Are you looking from the outside in at my command, which you are alienated from, do not see as a blessing, feel totally detached from? Or are you in here with me having some struggle? Because truth be told, depending on how you answer that question, this is going to go two very different ways. And the result is basically, right, I mean, the dialogue goes to a place of, I don't know, I heard you coming and I was afraid. And that's the answer of, oh, we're not on the same team here. And Vayigara Shata Adam can be read as, you know, oh, God expels the human being as a punishment. Or it can just be read as, okay, I guess you're not signed up for this project of being in the garden with me. You're going to have to make it elsewhere, and you're going to spend the rest of your existence trying to figure out if you can come back in. That's the sort of universalist version of, I think, what in many ways actually is the Jewish struggle with Torah and with command over time, and in particular for modern Jews. That question of Ayeka, are you inside looking out or outside looking in? And without pretending that it's easy and you just snap your fingers and say, well, I want to be inside, and then you're done, there is still actually a choice, a sort of point of orientation, and potentially a quest or lack thereof to be inside, identifying with the content and message of Torah, or to be outside, evaluating, maybe critiquing, being alienated from the message of Torah. Usually when people are alienated from Torah, there's plenty of blame to go around. I mean, sure, we can be guilty of our own alienation for not being sufficiently curious, for not being sufficiently generous. But a lot of times our teachers or our tradition are guilty for not letting us see the full multitude of possibilities of what Torah or halakha might have been able to offer, either by way of a message or by a kind of versatility of responding to the moment. On some level, if I were to sum up to you, like, the thing I'm most passionate about, and I think in some ways what this Beit Midrash really tries to be when it comes to halakha, we could say Torah writ large, is for people to identify with the content of the mitzvot and to experience them as a blessing rather than just a command, right? They are also a command. They are also expectations, but that they are expectations that are actually meant deep down to make us flourish and be the fullest and best versions of ourselves that we can be. I'll add my own autobiographical note here. I too grew up in two different homes and in certain ways in different contexts, religiously, geographically, denominationally. But one of the things I was given as a great gift was my two homes shared in common a basic pattern of observance, life of halakha, mitzvot, etc., in a way that was very kind of anchoring and, you know, stabilizing in all kinds of ways for me. But also, I think, gave me a sense through both of those homes of the ways in which even when actually other things were not totally certain, we didn't know how you were going to hold together all the different aspects of life, whether in this home or that home or this city or that city. There was a way in which Torah, halakha was kind of, it was my friend, it was my anchor, it was actually really a seat of blessing. I feel very lucky to have had that, but I'm also aware of the ways in which that's like idiosyncratic to what I happen to have been raised with. I sometimes actually feel limited as an educator in that regard of being able actually to, you know, from the inside, when we talk about inside and outside, share what does it look like to come to an appreciation of halakha, come to an appreciation of mitzvot. I do my best to kind of share what I feel I've had, you know, organically, but it's not always simple to do that. I think I'll leave that there. I'll just say, right, that notion of a journey to fulfilling expectations, feeling like it is also a journey to fulfillment, goes in both directions. There's the kind of making meaning out of going deeper into a sense of, okay, tradition has expected this of me. How can that bring meaning into my life? And then maybe we'll get into more of this with some of the questions. When we talk about what can sometimes feel like conflicts between values we hold or values that feel like they're present in the world and our understanding of what Torah and Halakha has to offer, there too we have different ways that we can proceed. You talk about a core question like gender equality in the context of a tradition that has a very long history that you would not classify with those two words. There are kind of two ways of thinking about that. One is what I would call kind of a more outside way of, well, I'm coming to this moment and to this tradition with a set of values, and I'm trying to figure out in an evaluative way from the outside, which pieces of this am I going to take, which am I going to change, which am I going to chip away with, which am I going to, you know, update. A different way, which I think is also very much the ethos both of us bring to this space, is a notion of a journey to an observant, egalitarian Jewish life that we try to live out in our personal lives and in this space, actually just being a journey to a deeper commitment of there being more people with more expectations, more obligations, more ability to contribute in a way that feels like it's our own answer to the, you know, Ayeka, where are we and where's the energy propelling us?
I get very stuck sometimes in the halachic world in the sense that do I still find meaning in it? Do I still find, forget about conflicts and battles that can happen too. For example, I'll give a very, very concrete example. So I just learned that sometimes in eating a vegetable soup, you don't say shakal, you say bari adama. And I'm saying, well, that's interesting. I would never have known that, but why is that important? I understand the importance of bringing spirituality in every act one does. I really get there, but you know, the ideal. going to the bathroom and saying Ashe Yotzer. But I do sometimes feel stuck at least in the minutia of halakha and wondering what meaning does it really have? And why does it get so detailed? So,
great.
So my question is also for Rabbi Aviva. I'd like to know how you went from women's studies to finding meaning in halakha.
So I accept all the premises you're putting on the table about Hadar trying to make halakha as a framework more meaningful for people and to bring more people into observance because it's a good thing for everyone to do. I, in my own personal experience, have found that if I actually wanted to try to live a halakhic life, I would only, as a practical matter, be able to do so if I went into a Orthodox community and surrounded myself with people who actually do. I live in Washington, D.C. There are lots of Jews, but trying to find a trad egalitarian community which would then like have all the social context that creates the kind of socially bound expectations of observance that I probably would need as a non-self-disciplined person. Mm-hmm. Is hard. So I buy the theory, mm-hmm. right? But actually putting it in practice is really hard.
Great. Thank you.
Well, I guess similar to that one, I'm David Serafiel from Washington, D.C. So I'm one of the more observant people that I know. So mm-hmm. deepening halakha, including members of my own family. So deepening halakha experience seems kind of cool, but it also means distancing myself from my own community. Mm-hmm. And also, some of it's not very practical. I don't live within walking distance of the shul that I like, and the shul that I'm within walking distance of, I don't like as much. So, maybe the question of at what point does observance conflict with making meaning? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so when I was in college, I went to Oberlin College, I had a daily chavruta at the beginning with Barya Schachter, who's the son of Reb Zalman Schachter, Shalomi Zichrona Livracha. We learned Masechet Brachot, the tractate all about blessings, and we got to the part about food blessings. And I will tell you, if you learn that part of Halacha with someone who's coming from like a neo-Hasidic renewal mindset, there's all sorts of meaning you can glean from learning the minutia of which blessings to say before food. So that's just a bit of an anecdote. That was a fun experience to share. So I want to say this, like, and maybe this is a little bit evasive, but in part, I think some of the minutia, right, which bracha is the right bracha to say on food given its form, that does take up a number of pages in the Talmud. But I think, you know, when you take something seriously, like, there's kind of no question that's too small. I don't know if anybody's done something like wedding planning or moving into a new house, right? It's like, actually, if there's something serious happening, then some of these questions of like, well, how is it actually going to play out, do end up occupying a lot of our mindset when we're like, how should we set up the tables for this session? That's because we really care about the session and what happens, and we don't want to be too far away from you, and we want to be sitting and not standing. If it's a discourse that takes itself seriously and feels like there's something at stake, then yes, the details do matter, partly just because they matter. Now, beyond that, I think the question of the substance of those details ties into, like, well, what are the food blessings doing in general? One of our students who recently finished Smicha here, Rabbi Beth Levy, taught a session here once on the connections between the language of food blessings and the first chapter of Bereishit, of Genesis, where you see sort of the origins of the world and how actually some language choices in the food blessings are there to really amplify the echo with the creation of the world. So I think sometimes that question of, you know, how much does the form of the food, like, remind you of the words that are used in that first chapter in Genesis, in the creation? It's like, yeah, this is supposed to bring me into relationship with the Creator in a certain way, and there's a level of consciousness around the form of my food that I have to sort of think about. So I do think sometimes there are really substantive things at play there, though I'm also saying that the fact of the discourse in and of itself having details in it is actually an expression of there being stakes, whatever those stakes might be. And I think a lot of the project of this Beit Midrash, I mean, we're doing a lot of different things in different settings and formats, but one thing that happens, if we are going to teach a halacha class in, for example, the laws of Shabbat, like, we will start that with the verses in the Torah that relate to that topic that can often be a more explicit container of the values that are at stake, and to trace how those play out in various detailed positions throughout the centuries. So we are kind of trying to teach from that perspective. In terms of the From Women's Studies to Finding Meaning in Halacha, I appreciate that question. I will actually say some of the most formative aspects of what I learned in some of the gender studies classes at Oberlin College were writings from third world feminists talking about what it means to claim their own culture as, to kind of claim their own culture not just as being kind of anti-feminist because it was kind of archaic, but to kind of feel at home within their own culture and to speak from within it, right? So instead of just standing from some sort of like Western feminist mindset and critique what was in some of their own culture, this includes like religious Muslim women, to actually claim their culture as their own and sort of ask their own questions about meaning and purpose and agency from within that language. So I do think for me, part of this journey is wanting to take that journey of fluency to be able to kind of honestly ask myself, like, what do I find, what am I seeing that feels compelling and valuable and interesting and complex from within my own tradition, right, from within halacha. So that gets to this inside-outside, right? Are you in the garden? Are you outside the garden? I think for me, that trajectory from women's studies and gender studies that sort of propelled me to study, we were actually studying tractic tubot that year after college. It has a lot to do with gender and virginity and sexuality and all sorts of things that from an outside perspective, you might be like, that does not speak to our own world and our understanding what it means for like women to have full dignity and agency. I felt like if I'm kind of speaking inside the text, I can ask my questions in like from within the text. And that feels exciting to me personally, and it feels exciting to me in terms of our halacha kind of re-becoming what it needs to become in terms of having all of the voices of Klal Yisrael, right, all, the whole kind of Jewish people identifying with it and speaking from inside. I don't know if that's too abstract, but I think that's really the move for me. Okay, I'll respond to one other one and then get to the... Well, actually, maybe these next two questions, they're sort of similar in some ways. It's sort of like the interpersonal dimensions of living an observant lifestyle. I would just say, I wouldn't say that one of our goals is to make people more observant. Maybe some people experience that, but we do want people to at least see what it could look like to be observant, to know if that might be something that actually is like meaningful to them. Right. We want halacha to sort of speak in its most relatable sense. But yes, the way that our observance, our quest for observance, might actually be something that creates barriers with people in our lives. I can say that very directly in my own life. I have an extremely gracious and generous father who was like very open to facilitating my own religious journey towards more observance when I was younger. So I guess for me, I'll say two things. First, towards the more personal, kind of familial context, and the mitzvot as a blessing instead of just a burden or command. I do think if we're living out halacha properly, so to speak, or in its best sense, it should be something that at least parts of that experience will facilitate deeper relationship with other people in our lives, even if they're not doing it in the same way. Right? Shabbat is a great example. Shabbat can create a million barriers. We all know that. We're going to not drive places or, you know, not cook on Shabbat. There's all sorts of barriers for relationship. But actually, I do think part of Shabbat at its core is about getting to have a day designated to really being in the present and being with people in your life who are with you. And so for me, I grew up spending one Shabbat in sort of Orthodox Baltimore and one Shabbat with my dad in a mostly Protestant neighborhood in Baltimore. And when Shabbat became the time, we're like, yes, I was doing a lot of cooking before Shabbat. And then we could sit and have endless meals together and chat. Like there was a way of like bringing him in. And I spent time going on very long walks with my Unitarian friend, and we weren't watching movies on Shabbat because we were going on long walks instead or chatting at the table. So I, you know, sometimes that's harder and sometimes it's easier, but I do think it should be possible for at least parts of that halachic observance. I guess part of what I'm saying is actually think from the outset, the intention of what that halachic observance should look like in one's life, whatever the circumstances are, the interpersonal connective piece is actually kind of a part of what that picture looks like. Obviously, there's things that don't work sometimes, but I think that's an angle. The community piece... yes, this is hard. And I would say like one of our core missions is, you know, long term, whatever number of years the vision is for it. And I would say I sometimes speak about this in extremely grandiose terms, which I realize are grandiose. But like the world needs the possibility of living in sort of very thick Jewish religious community that is also very committed to egalitarianism and kind of non-fundamentalism, and yet is still extremely rigorous and consistent and joyful. Like, that must exist in the world. It is a problem for the world, for the Jewish world. I would say not only the Jewish world. If kind of the only possibility for kind of really, you know, a sense of like really day-to-day devotional community is paired with a certain kind of fundamentalist picture around gender and other things. So how are we going to get there? We're working on a whole lot of different modes at once. And honestly, just hoping that more and more people can sort of see the possibility, find each other, make this happen in different settings and different ways across different life stages. But it's something that we feel very committed to. Again, that doesn't mean that all Jews participate in it, but it must be something on the map of what Jewish community contains.
I'll add just a couple supplemental points. Just also to affirm, I think your description of reality is often correct, and you know, language we'll use around this sometimes of talking about the importance of peer reinforcement in living out Jewish life, right? The idea that you can turn the person to your left and to your right, and actually something you're wanting to do, they're already doing, or they're available to help you do that, right? It's why people are part of running clubs, right? Like, some people can run alone, but a lot of people actually, if they don't have a gym buddy, right, or someone to be able to do that with, it's much harder, and that's really true. That said, without taking anything away from that, I think it is important to note, and I think one of the things that's actually really powerful about the mosaic of mitzvot is that there are some mitzvot that are, they're really, in their essence, about some kind of communal structure that supports it. Obviously, something like prayer with a minyan, you can't even do it without 9 other people. But in a lot of ways, a certain kind of Shabbat atmosphere construction really depends on, right, other people being bought in. You know, I think this is like an interesting, it's an interesting challenge that was not the case on campuses now than on, like, we were undergraduates of, you know, when I was an undergraduate, it didn't matter what you were doing elsewhere. When you were in the building, no one had a smartphone because they hadn't invented the smartphone, right? Maybe someone had a pen in their pocket and someone didn't have a pen in their pocket, but just by dint of walking into the space, you were sort of signing up for a shared experience. Our digitally connected world and lives are intrinsically in every moment, right, pulling us out. I give that just by way of perspective of, this is not only a question of Jewish halachic observance, etc. You know, we try to set up a Beit Midrash space here. How do we, without being totally overbearing, you know, being like, you really shouldn't have your phone out because we're trying to create chavruta here. It requires buy-in, right? It requires that that presence. But there are other things like putting on tefillin, right? Or any number of other things that actually really are, if not private mitzvot, things that don't depend in the same way, right, on that peer reinforcement. And I think sometimes when you think about journeys, or how do I, you know, if someone would describe themselves as, I'm trying to, or I'm looking to go to a different place than, you know, than I am, then yeah, you do sometimes. I mean, I think Chabad in its own way, with a very different kind of theology than we mainly embrace here, has this insight that not all mitzvot are the same, and not all people connect to them in the same way or will easily pick them up in the same way. And I think that's a very important message, and one that we share. You know, I'll say that as the second half of that, in terms of what does it mean to, you know, to sort of deal with the tensions of, do I have the people around me? Do I have the geography around me to make all things, you know, come together? And like, A, there too, like, affirm that. That is not simple, and there are all kinds of things that are that way. You know, I may wake up any number of mornings and say, like, should I be living in Israel? Is that where I should be? And are there, what are the things that hold me back from that? Like, it's not the $1,200 plane ticket. Like, that's not really that much money, right? In the grand scheme of things. There's other things that are real, or questions of, is that what I want? Where do I want to be? So we all grapple with things like that. I think the one thing I would offer on this, I remember my one time, it's a long time ago, like walking with my father, and we were walking past like a, it was like a pond with, you know, a bunch of geese that were there. And he said, "You see those geese? They're like exactly like their great grandparental geese. Like they do the same thing. They're literally the same animal." And you go back like four generations, right? Actually, in any human culture, even without the technological advancement, right? Like, Rava's Torah looked nothing like Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's Torah. Like, a huge amount happened in those four generations. That's the way human beings are, right? The worthwhile things do as human beings that make us not like geese are things that are always longer than our own lifetime. And I would say, I think about this in, you know, with respect to different variables, perhaps than like Shabbat observance, which might be a given in my life, but I think about it all the time in terms of my kids and, God willing, grandchildren and great-grandchildren who have not yet been born. Actually, the long arc of what I'm in this for is what am I going to help build over four generations, right? Avraham Avinu has to sit there hearing a divine promise of, they're going to go for 400 years in slavery. V'dor revi'i yashuvu heina. There's going to be a fourth generation that's going to come back. And we read that. That's legible to us as a promise, right? Not as saying, well, you're going to have nothing. Even though in terms of his life, kind of had nothing, right? Like he wasn't actually able to achieve anything about him having a kind of sovereign, independent, settled on the land reality. But there was a sense of, yeah, but if you're working towards something, actually sometimes that plays out over generations. So I can't speak to what is it about children, grandchildren, students, grandstudents, etc., you know, that may be in your life or anyone here's life, but I would urge that vision on it, right? It's not just a question of, well, I have the right variables and the shul that I go to. It's, what role am I playing in the grand narrative that things may look a different way a couple generations out? I'll just say one other piece here on the minutiae front. Just one reflection on this also reminded me of something. So, you know, first of all, I would say there's minutiae and there's minutiae, right? In other words, there's the minutiae in the sense of what Rabbi Aviva is like, I think, redeeming of, no, like there's real, you know, details there. And then there are sometimes, right, discussion, maybe more than sometimes, things that feel like they're so over the top on the number of angels on a head of a pin question that you can, right, you can ask those questions. My Zadie of blessed memory, he used to, you know, open up a page of the Shulchan Aruch, look at like the Prima Gadim, one of the commentators there, and say, these guys would have cured cancer had they had the chance to. The amount of mental energy that was poured into the, where else is the mind going to go? And then, of course, that happened in many ways, right, in the Jewish world later. And so there's a frustration there that I don't think is always wrong with every genre. But I do want to just loop back to what Rabbi Aviva said, which is, and I think it makes a big difference how you talk about those details. And one of the things we try to do pretty consistently in this Beit Midrash, not that we never have fun for its own sake, but I think when we're doing our job well, you will hear every teacher in this Beit Midrash try to tease out, this detail is really encoding this idea, this value, this principle, this point of inspiration. And that's maybe where that title of, you know, Jewish law and Jewish values, right, the idea of, is it always being tied back into that? And I think that matters.
I guess I didn't fully know that both you came from multiple houses and multiple worlds. And that, I think, speaks a lot, and I think a lot of people experience. I think my question is this tension between halakha and this and other worlds, and the intersections and the ways that, like, I'm curious how gender studies has informed halakha and the way that, like, I have a lot of non-Jewish friends, and like some of my best friends are on my ultimate frisbee team, and I try to find a hotel that's closest to the field so I can walk to the field, try to live in those two worlds. But it feels like, in what ways are they tensions in that dynamic, and also in what ways are they actually enhanced, and the way to get to the life we want to live, we need those two typically about intersections, about when you find a world that is different than yours and is compelling. Like, how does Halakha speak to that? Like,
mm-hmm.
How do you make that work?
Right. Yeah.
Hi. Can you talk a little about where, from your perspectives, Halakha influences your views on egalitarianism? For me, personally, at least, it's the other way around. Like, my coming from a conservative synagogue background, it's whatever. Like, for me, egalitarianism informs my Judaism as opposed to vice versa. And so I love the idea of creating a halakhic framework that is intrinsically promulgating these roles, but, like, you know, this is really reductive, but if you read the text or do any amount of exploration, it's just always way, the shot reading is always way simpler and generally often less egalitarian. So, and I know this is getting to your point, Rabbi, that you said, but I'm really curious to hear a little more about how that thinking goes for you. How you
mm-hmm.
ground your sense of halakhic egalitarianism.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah.
Examples like feminism, egalitarianism, and Judaism, and the conflict there. I feel like that's an inside conversation, and then I worry also because we're kind of balancing from the inside. But then I struggle with the outside conversation with people, not the logistics of interacting with them, but the conversation, which often can turn to apologetics. We really don't like hearing defensive and apologetic about topics such as racism. You know, or even what is Judaism's feelings about democracy, about kings and such in the land of Israel? Some bigger ideas that maybe don't jive with our personal, like, American sensibilities, but also really feel off when you're talking to someone from the outside, non-Jew, from the outside. When you talk about the geese who look like the great geese, that doesn't always sit well when we say, I really like you, we're best friends, and we're going to date you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A question, something I spent a good deal thinking about, and I'm almost like nervous to ask it, but when...
It's probably
of, like,
a perfect question.
Of, like, what it means to be in versus out. And I love the framing of the, you know, Bereshit question of, you know, Ayeka, and, like, are you in this with me or are you not? And I feel, you know, just to help flesh out my question using myself as an example, though I don't think this is unique to me, like, am I in this with God of, like, being a Jew and my relationship with Hashem being the most important thing in my life? Like, 5,000,000,000% yes. And... like, topless, checking the mitzvah boxes, I'm aware that I don't do all of the things, either because I don't know what they are or because I choose not to. And, you know, I love Hadar so much, and I'm learning here so much, and learned a lot of the halakha lessons that I've taken on from this Beit Midrash. And I also, you know, I'm wondering, like, what it means, like, the are you in or are you out? And what happens when the answer is, like, chetzi-chetzi, and it depends on all of these things? And is that... So I would love to know, like, how you feel about that. Is that okay, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just to jump in on that one. You know, I think I actually appreciate the ability to sort of clarify here. The language construct, to the extent it's helpful, of in or out is not, to me, equivalent to the question of, I'll just use sort of your language, do I do everything? Do I check all the boxes? In other words, that may also be important. I'll come back to that in a second. But in other words, if we go back to my imagination of the story that might have been, right? Had Adam HaRishon, the first human being's answer to Ayeka, been, yeah, I just had this amazing experience. I ate the fruit. I know I shouldn't have done it, but, like, I want to talk to you about what happened. I'm experiencing the world completely differently. I feel bad about this. Can we work this through? I don't know if they would have been expelled. right? In other words, on some level, the answer was, well, I'm naked, so I hid. And then it's like, well, why do you know that, right? In other words, you've actually concealed the most important thing from me, and you've indicated we're not actually in dialogue here. That would be being in, even
this
though he still ate from the tree.
Contemporary Midrash you just wrote.
Well, there we go. right, that would be being in with the same background thing of eating from the tree, right, and violating the command. Now, there might still be work to do of still shouldn't have eaten from the tree, or God doesn't want that. But I'm talking more about positionality and attitude and relationship and commitment than necessarily sort of right bottom line. Now, I think in terms of behavior and how does one follow up on commitments, I think this is maybe also looping back to, you know, the question earlier of like, oh, is the goal to get people more observant? I would say that's like the wrong question. The Torah is clearly manifestly an ongoing call to the Jewish people and to individual Jews with expectations. That's what it is. It's just what it is. It's not about, I think it's that. It's Daber al b'nei Yisrael. Da, 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 da. Speak to them, tell them, command them, etc. That's what it is. To the extent we have a role as teachers, it's to be worthy mouthpieces for that Torah, for God's Torah, and to see, can we teach it? Can we share it? Can we make that call intelligible to people? At the end of the day, that journey is actually, again, descriptively, it's not a normative claim, descriptively each person's individual journey. We're not the voice on Sinai. We're not even, right, we're not Moses the intermediary. We are just somehow, again, maybe worthy and maybe effective mouthpieces for it. So I think that's how I feel about it. I feel my responsibility as a teacher is to the extent I feel like I have some access to understanding something that maybe can be helpful for someone who is trying to understand or interested in hearing and wants to be in the sense I described it of whatever you're doing, whatever you are yet doing, have decided to do, etc., that you're looking to hear that voice, right? That's our job, which is not a small job, but is also, it's actually limited in a certain way. So we can talk about it more, but that's my initial take. I'll pause, we can go back and forth.
Yeah, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but while you were speaking and sharing this question, which I appreciate very much, I was thinking of this amazing commentary, I think it's by the Orach Chaim, about that there's this tradition that there's, you know, the number of mitzvot correspond to the limbs of the body. But actually, like, nobody can do all the mitzvot of the Torah, right? Some of them only apply to Kohanim. You know, it's like, actually, no individual, zero, can be that, like, paradigm of the body that is doing all the mitzvot, right? That's just not true. So the Or HaChaim sort of talks there about, like, the collective of the Jewish people as kind of embodying Torah altogether. So I say that not to be like, okay, so then what I do doesn't necessarily matter that much, but just I think always to remember that none of us are doing everything all the time, and certainly when we take into account various mitzvot aseh, right, those positive commandments that don't have a ton of contours, she'in lahem shiur, like chesed and tzedakah, like all sorts of mitzvot that, you know, some people may be amplifying more than others. I think just to reiterate, the being in isn't the same as I'm checking all the mitzvah boxes every day. But I do think there's some sort of like mindset around that that can be important. Meaning like that some sort of aspirational and striving mindset is different than a like, well, I'm just adamantly, you know, ignoring X, Y, Z thing. I will just also say, I think that the questions around community and circumstances and, you know, modernity America and sort of in what ways communities are set up to enable people to practice mitzvot more fully in a way that is really sort of supported and is part of living out communal life. Right? When there's not a ton of options on the table around what that looks like in contemporary America, I think it's not fair as individuals to feel like, oh, this all rests on my shoulders and my in or out depends on, you know, the specific actions I'm taking. I wanted to actually, it's not unrelated to this question from Eitan about halacha and other worlds. It just so we remember, okay, like in the medieval period, there were a lot of traveling merchants, especially from Christian Europe, who would go on long journeys and would find themselves like really in places where like you couldn't find a hectored bag of pretzels or trail mix or something. It's like, meaning just like the history of people trying to observe halacha and being in different worlds, just like economically what was included being in all sorts of places. So I think it's important to remember that in some ways, like the assumption that one could always be in a world where like it's fully possible to live out halacha ideally, right? In some ways that's, I don't know if you want to call it a luxury or perhaps a liability of our contemporary era to some extent. So, you know, that being said, I sort of want to say two things in response to your question. One is, and certainly like part of living in the contemporary American life, is like, what language is there in halacha kind of explicitly to value, you know, what you're describing as like, I want to make sure I get to this ultimate frisbee match and, you know, I'm going to do all the work and figure the hotel that's closest, but like where's the language that sort of values that? And, you know, I think there are some sort of like different things that emerge, but like that is a sort of project, right? And one could be on that project to find some of the language that values that, including language that might like really value friendships with people who are in different worlds. So I just want to name like that's, I think, actually one piece of your question is like, what is our language to name and value that? In terms of experientially, right, is it attention or does it enhance our practice? I will just say, I actually shared this a little bit earlier today because there was someone here who spent a lot of time in North Carolina. We were talking about this. I went to music camp growing up when I was in middle school, high school in North Carolina. And, you know, sort of like a week at a time. And I would like bring all my pre-prepared kosher food there and like figure out who I was going to stay with for Shabbos in the community, which meant it was like a cool way to meet and connect people in the community. It was often like the first Jew people were meeting coming from rural parts of North Carolina. And it was like a real exercise in strengthening my Jewish identity to have those times. And I learned a lot of music, you know, being in that setting. So now, do I fully have the halachic language to describe why that was like lechatchila, or like that's a good thing to do, and not just navigating something that's like making it harder to observe Jewish law for those weeks? I don't think I can totally put my finger on that language, but I do think from the, again, like I'm saying, well, maybe if you like remember that in medieval Europe, people were traveling and going, maybe spending most months of the year, like not in a Jewish community in that way. Like, I think some of the premise of the question it's worth asking about. And certainly experientially, I think we know to have those kind of excursions into different worlds can actually be strengthening. But some I think depends on also having like a strong sense of home base that's a little more reinforcing.
I'll jump in with one thing. I don't know if this premise would work for you, but I think one of the things I would offer on that, I don't think it's the only place, but you have this beautiful rabbinic interpretation of the verse, Yafta Elohim le'yefet v'yishkon ba'ahol le'shem. May God bestow beauty, play of words, on Yefet, the youngest son of Noah, Japheth, whose name sounds like beauty, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, Shem, of course, is the ancestor of Abraham and then later the Semitic peoples, right, including the Hebrews and the Jews. That verse is invoked by our sages to be the sort of inspiration for why, and get this one because this has fallen out of use in practice, why you can write a Sefer Torah in Greek. Okay? That sort of fell out of normative practice. But you have there what is very clearly one strand of rabbinic tradition that basically thinks The Greek language is amazing. It's an incredibly beautiful language. It's also the language of the empire. It's the sort of passcode into connecting with humanity writ large. And God wants the merger of those things when they're good and when they enhance the covenant, right, in some deep way. You know, can we expand that ethos to things like, well, God wants you to learn music and, you know, experience amazing things. And, you know, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was famously, you know, always asked, like, when he was, you know, vacationing in Switzerland, like, you know, what are you doing? He says, when I get to the heavenly abode, God's going to say, have you seen my Alps? And if I can't answer, right, I'm going to be in trouble. And a sort of recognition of there's beauty and there's things in the world, and we can extend that in all kinds of ways. I would pivot that to the question that you asked about, and obviously we could spend a lot of time on the individual issues, racism, democracy, intermarriage, et cetera. And I think all of those issues merit their own kind of in-depth discussion from inside, in Torah, et cetera. But the overarching take, I would say, that has to motivate our discussions of that sort is, and here I'm not claiming this is the only strand in the rabbinic tradition, but it's a strand, and it's the strand with which I line up with. I think Jews should see themselves as twice blessed. We are members of a unique, distinctive covenant between God and the Jewish people, and we are human beings. And we are both of those things. And there is no such thing as answering a question from a Jewish perspective that is not also meant to be intelligible from a human perspective. Now, something being intelligible does not mean everyone agrees with you, does not mean at first blush everyone gets it as intuitive. But I do actually think if it goes in a way to the translation of details to values also. If you can't figure out, take the time you need, but if you can't figure out how to explain something that's a deep commitment of yours on the New York Times op-ed page, that's actually a lack. That is a problem. That is a deficiency in your self-understanding, your powers of articulation, how much you've gone deep into Torah to find the right language, or how much you've found the bridging language to be able to speak as a human being to your fellow human being. Some of our fellow human beings are wicked, right? That's a reality, unfortunately. And whether we think that's intrinsically so, or we can bring them back from the brink, again, you have impasses with people because sometimes they, to your understanding of the world, are on the side of bad. That's not what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about not being in an argument with someone where you feel like they're on the side of bad. I'm talking about writing someone off as irrelevant to how a kind of mirror, right? Writing someone off as a mirror you have to be able to hold up to yourself. I think humanity is always a mirror that must be held up, right, to Torah in the sense of how does Torah communicate on that broader platform, even as we recognize Torah is not in its entirety just a universalist message, right? But Torah did decide to ground the first 11 chapters of its story of how we became a people in something that has nothing to do with Judaism. Which is to say, the kinds of stuff I started with, right? My ability to quote those chapters and to quote the Hebrew word of Ayeka is because the Torah was written in a way that assumes there's actually a human backdrop to that Jewish story. So I actually think beginning with that gets you a lot of the way there. It doesn't get you to, okay, I should say it this way or this person will hear it that way, but it gets you a lot of the way there of, well, I have to be able to work this through in a way that at least I feel is plausible and tangible to my non-Jewish neighbor, friend, larger culture, etc. And to the extent, again, you feel like you're trapped in a culture that's taking things in a horrible way, well then, you may need to resist against that culture, you might need to move out of it, you might need to do any number of things. But I think that's, until you've reached that crisis point, right, that kind of bridging needs to happen. But I'm acknowledging, like, with each case, beyond the scope of what, you know, we have time for here, that's what would motivate me to sit down and say, okay, how can I explain in terms that whether they'll be accepted immediately or not, what do I mean as someone with a commitment to being a human being if I have a commitment that love or marriage is wrapped up in a covenantal envelope? And how do I explain that to someone? And how do I explain that there's pathways into that? And how do I explain, you know, how you see that manifest in the world? But that becomes, I think, the obligation.
And I might sort of pick up from there. In some ways, this is a little bit related to your question, which we won't leave hanging. But I think, you know, that is important and valuable, and sort of not being embarrassed or ashamed about what Torah has to say is very critical for what Torah wants itself to be. Right? Torah wants itself to be something that other nations will point at and be like, wow, that's a source of wisdom. And Maimonides, in his little dedication to the Mishnah Torah, his codification of Jewish law, quotes, "As lo evush," right? I won't be embarrassed when I gaze at all of your commandments, which you could take as meaning, I've made this concise, so I won't forget them, and I'll know that I'm keeping them, and I'll remember them. But you could also take it as, like, he actually kind of feels ashamed when he's looking at the Torah, because there's all these things that seem like they go against reason in how he understands that, because he's integrated with a larger cultural intellectual world. And he's writing this because he's like, I want to have the language, what?
Be inside.
Be inside, and right, and say, like, and I'm not ashamed about these mitzvot. I have my way of understanding them that feels like it's not, you know, it's not kind of destructive in what he believes in. But I actually think that's not enough, right? Because I think the real question is not just can we sort of, like, in a little bit you're talking about a PR game. You're not only talking about a PR game, because it is an internal exercise to be able to do that work of writing the op-ed in the New York Times. But a little bit that's about, like, okay, how can I make sure I have the capacity to articulate, you know, Jewish law in a way that's not alienating to people. But what we really need Torah to do is to engage with our real questions about things we care about, right? So when you talk about racism, democracy, intermarriage, right, to not be in a stance of I'm going to evaluate what Torah says about these things, and then either it's good or bad. And if it looks bad, I better have the language to describe how it's not actually bad, right? That's not actually helpful to us. Maybe it's helpful for people not, like, hating Judaism or something. What we need Torah to do is to respond to our real questions. Like, identifying and confronting racism is hard. Our society is not doing a good enough job. We, as part of our larger society, are not doing everything we need to do on building a culture that is not racist. What are our real questions? This gets back to the, from women's studies to being on the inside of halakha, right? What are my actual questions? As somebody who has access to Torah and tradition, it's all of its sort of depth of language, where am I finding things that might be helpful in engaging with my real questions? Actually, Rav Avi Killip is sort of an amazing example on this. She's been doing a lot of teaching on racism in the Talmud, where she's not studying what the Talmud has to say about race specifically, right? She's looking at what are questions I have in my own culture around racism and how embedded it is in a cultural system, and what in halakha sort of gives me tools to interface with something that could be very embedded culturally, and I'm trying to sort of navigate around or shift or get away from it. And she turns to Avodah Zarah, all the laws about idolatry, which contain a lot of minutia, but are essentially around, like, interfacing with a world that has some level of a toxic culture all around you, and figuring out, like, what is my personal responsibility within that world and framework, right? So that, I think, is extremely powerful and generative. Not just being like, okay, I'm going to figure out the way to talk about Torah so when people are pointing at it from the outside, it doesn't look bad, but both for ourselves and to the extent it's helpful for others, to, like, ask our real questions and search for what we need in our tradition that can help engage in the constructive and very hard work that we have to do. So, and I think when it comes to things like democracy and what that looks like on the ground, and, right, intermarriage, right, how, like, what what is marriage about, and what are the expectations around, you know, living our lives in the fullest way that we want to and can, in a really embodied way in family, right? Those are real questions. Okay, now I'm still puzzling over your question. We have 2 minutes. Great. So how does halakha affect views on egalitarianism, and not just how does egalitarianism affect views on halakha? So in theory, like based on what I just said, it should be that halakha has what to teach on how to do egalitarianism better. You have that beautiful source from, what, it's the Sifrei, Benot Slavchad.
Yeah.
As one example, I'll let you say that. I won't steal it from you.
No, please.
It might not be relevant.
It's not mine.
But I can't say that. Sorry, that's just about, like, you know, there's God's picture of human relations and what it should look like, which sort of maximizes divine chesed and dignity for others, and sort of benot slavchad are kind of expecting that from Moshe, and that on a human interpersonal level we can maybe get a little bit closer to that. So as opposed to this being like an external value that benot slavchad are bringing in, it's like, no, that is sort of a real divine value, and we're just trying to approach that, get closer to it. And in terms of a more explicit example, I don't know. If I'm honest with you, and this may not be helpful, and it might be too second wave feminist, I'm not sure. But for me, what's feeling powerful recently, I would say, like, especially going through the experience of like giving birth and having children, is sort of parts of our tradition and halakha that like speak to the embodied experience of kind of motherhood and how that intersects with prayer, and like really wanting to honor that and bring that into Tefillah. That might be too personal and too narrow as a response to your question, but in some ways I think that's sort of the mindset to be in. Like, what is actually resonating in this text with real questions? And to the extent that I sort of sometimes see a world where the way people think about prayer, Jewish prayer, like, doesn't feel like it's fully encompassing human experience, and especially some of women's embodied experience. Like, that's one thing that's been captivating some of my attention. You want the last word?
I'll give it just a final gloss on that question, and then we'll wrap. And we're happy to stick around. I think I can stick around for a few minutes. I know your time. You may have to run out, but I can stick around for a few minutes when anyone wants to. Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of things I learned over the course of, I feel like, delving into those sources. But in some ways, to loop back to one thing I mentioned earlier, when you spend a lot of time with halakha and you confront that it is primarily a discourse of dignity manifested through obligation more than it is dignity manifested through rights. It's not that there's no rights, but it's primarily a discourse that manifests that way. You start to understand, in a way I don't think I did at the beginning of my journey, looking for some of the syntheses I was exploring, that I wasn't looking for a way to make something possible. I was actually learning from within how to have higher expectations of myself, my community, my children, etc., in a way that manifests as a practice of gender equality, but actually is something much deeper in that regard. When I think I had already reached this point by that point, but you know, it meant when my daughter, who is my oldest, turned 12, I did not think of it as a moment of, oh yeah, I think we're actually, according to the way we think of Judaism, allowed to say the special invitation to the grace after meals that you only say with a group of three. Right up till that point, just been me and my wife and a kid. It was this moment of, oh wow, there's like three obligated adults here. We actually have an obligation now to show up in an augmented way around this ritual, and what it meant to present that to her not as an opportunity, but actually as, you know, a sacred obligation and a role for her to step into. That's something I don't think I would have gotten from my egalitarian commitments or proclivities, such as they were from the broader culture. That had to actually come from within.
Our producers for this episode are Sam Greenberg and Jeremy Tabak. Thank you to Nadav Remez for editing this episode. I'm your host, Rabbi Avi Killip. It's been a pleasure to learn with you.